Raised on D&D Podcast helps to enrich your family's gaming experience by bringing you interviews with parents, educators, game designers, and influencers. Join us as we delve into the many ways that tabletop role-playing games inspire creativity, develop communication skills, and create long-lasting bonds among players. Your host has been an avid gamer since childhood, and now his kids are being raised on D&D. Here is your host, Nick Cardarelli.
Welcome back, gamers. I'm your host, Nick Cardarelli, and this is Raised on D&D. My next guest is originally from Tennessee and is currently living in a small town at the foot of the Alps in Bavaria, Germany. He's the author of Blue Flame Tiny Stars and the Little Lot series. He's the blogger behind Dungeonlands.com. He's currently working on Fencer's Pandemonium Society House Rules, making Holmes Basic a complete game, written from the perspective of a group of early 1980s pre-adolescent players. Please welcome Stephen Wendell. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Nick. How you doing?
Fantastic. Stephen, thank you so much for being on the show today. We're so excited to have you. I've been following the blog, enjoying the book, all of these great things. We're going to talk about that in just a second. But before we jump into all of that, can you take us back to your first experience with tabletop role-playing games, Dungeons & Dragons?
That's a surprising question, Nick, coming from you. It's like a tick you have. I was prepared for it. 41 years ago, I was living in Middle Tennessee, in a tiny town in Middle Tennessee. My best friend lived across the street from me. We were in the same class together. Everything was going great. And then my family moved away to East Tennessee. And so it was terrible because I missed my best friend. Nothing was the same, but there was nothing to do about it because 6 months later, he moved away too. His family moved to another town, not so far away, but far away from me. And so the next summer, I went to visit him, and the kids in his neighborhood played D&D. So when I walked in the door, I remember, I'll never forget it, I was holding my suitcase, and he was across the room, standing across the room, and he held up this pale blue book, and he said, "Man, you've got to play this game." I was like, okay, sure, we can play this game, but at the same time, there was something in the air. I don't know what it was. It felt like some energy, something was happening. And I was like, something is changing right now. I don't know what it is, but something important is going to happen. And it did.
That's fantastic. That was the Holmes Basic pale blue book.
Yeah.
A lot of the folks listening, some of them have come in later editions, second edition, third, even some folks listening have come in fifth edition. So Stephen, can you take a moment and just tell the folks at home what the Holmes edition of Dungeons and Dragons was, and maybe a little bit of how it was different from what maybe the D&D that they know today?
Well, before Holmes, the Holmes edition, Holmes Basic, there was original D&D, which was written for wargamers. There were no role players back then. It was just wargamers. And so Gygax and Arneson, they had this idea to play these fantastic games as individual characters instead of as armies or generals. And so they wrote these rules, and they were for wargamers, and it was complicated and messy. And so Eric Holmes, who was a brain doctor, he had the idea, and he played with his kids. So he sent a message to Gary Gygax that I'd like to rewrite the rules for, you know, to make them comprehensible for children. And Gygax agreed with that. I think they were already thinking about doing that sort of thing. So he let him do it. And so he wrote these rules for the first three levels. Only first through third level, sort of basic rule set. So it's only like 48 pages. And they published it, and it happened to be that at the same time there was D&D got some press, some what they call bad press, but there is no such thing as bad press. So the basic set was out and it started selling because of this, because of the press that we call the period, the Satanic Panic. But it sold really well. And so it became popular. And so a lot of people learned to play using that edition. But what's different about it is that it's not complete. It was only intended to be the first three levels. And then you're supposed to go on to AD&D. And the rules are, Holmes was trying to make it simple. So he simplified a lot of things. And some things are just kind of in editing after, because apparently somebody edited after, and it was we think it was probably Gygax himself who did the editing. And then in editing, some things got confused and it's kind of a mess. Like daggers get to attack twice per round, and all of the weapons do D6 points of damage. So everybody fights with a dagger. If you're going to, you know, if you're min-maxing, you fight with a dagger. There's no reason why anybody would have ever forged a sword, you know, if daggers are so efficient. Anyway, so that's essentially what Holmes is all about. It's a beloved edition because of its idiosyncrasies.
I think that's fantastic. The idea that as early on as 1979, 1980, there was this idea of how can we take the idea of Dungeons and Dragons and make it more suitable for a younger audience to introduce them to it. And I think that is incredible, because when mine were young, I've got three little stair steps. Now they're much older now. They're 17, 16, almost 15. But when I started with them, they were 4, 3, 2.5. And I had to take the additions that were available at the time and kind of watered them down. If I had known that the Holmes edition was simpler and easier and that sort of thing, I could have used something like that. Now there's all kinds of games that are directly geared towards younger players and are designed like that. So I think that is really, really incredible. Steven, tell us a little bit about Blue Flame Tiny Stars, that book. Is kind of a your memoirs, but it's put into a character perspective. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, the character is me. It's it's a memoir of when I learned to play, the week that I spent with my best friend in Middle Tennessee. He showed me the dice, and he told me that we'll play tomorrow when my neighbor friend comes over. And he showed me the dice and all these, he called them polyhedrons. And I was just amazed. I was like, wow, they can have dice that have more than six sides. They can have dice that have less than six sides. How do you roll these things? Even the ones, I mean, the D4, okay, how do you roll? Natural question. But even the ones like the D8 or a D12, you look at them in your hand, you're like, how do you know which is on top? It's it's completely alien. These dice. And so it was this whole experience just looking at the dice and then imagining, what are we going to do with these dice? And so the next day when his friend came over, then I understood, because it was just amazing. His friend was, when I met him, he took this piece of paper out of his back pocket and unfolded it, said, "This is my character. His name is Katar. He's a sixth level magic user." And I was like, whoa, 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 magic user? This is going to be good. And so I watched them play, and then I played, and you know, it was amazing, an amazing experience. So that's what the book is all about, that week learning to play.
I really enjoy the introduction when you're describing going over to your friend's house and all of the the full description of the home, the dining room, the kitchen area, that sort of thing. And I'm reading it. And because being from that era, I was able to very clearly envision the scene. And it was very nostalgic for me. So I really enjoyed that part of the book. And you have written Little Lot Now, this is an Arthurian series, is that right?
No, the first book is Arthurian legend. It's the story of it's a story of Lancelot and his rescue of Guinevere. The second book is the series is generally about this little boy who he plays games and he tells the stories about playing the games. It's always on two levels. So in the first book, he's playing with his action figures in the floor of his granddad's study. And he has a Lancelot character. And so his character goes off and does all these adventures while his grandfather does the voices for the other characters. He plays the other characters. And so Little Lot tells the story of this adventure. And he has a Barbie doll who sits in as who he plays as Guinevere and the whole thing. And then the second one is he's in bed at night and he thinks there's a monster in the room. And so he overcomes his fear of the monster in order to save his family. Third one is yet unpublished. There's three more that aren't published yet. There's a pirate story. There's another one is a fantasy adventure. It's called The Great Little Lot and the Great Horn of the Unicorn, where he plays a role-playing game that looks a whole lot like Dungeons and Dragons. With his brother and his brother's friends. So they're sitting around the table playing a game, and we see in his mind they're, you know, in a fantastic world having this adventure. And then the fifth one is a Norse mythology. It's the story of Ragnarok, essentially, and it retells a lot of the Norse myths along the way.
And about how long are the books and what reading level?
They vary widely. So the shortest one is probably the pirate story, and it's only a few pages. Reading level is going to be, for all of them, is between 6 and 8. The longest one is going to be like 120 pages, I think, something around there. The two longer ones are around 120.
So perfect for parents to read with their children as well as for children to read on their own.
When I write Little Lot, I write with the parent in mind. I want for the parent to read the story to the kids. And so I want to write an engaging story that a parent will enjoy. And I want to write a story that's not, you know, that you don't feel like, oh goodness, I got to read this, you know, thing for the 3-year-old again. I made the character Little Lot. He's precocious. He's writing this thing, but he sometimes uses big words and he explains them along the way. So you don't necessarily have to get out the dictionary to read to your kid. But I try to make it fun for the parent as well as the child.
Terrific. So I have been having a great time exploring dungeonlands.com and seeing your blogs and your posts there. Tell folks when they visit dungeonlands.com what they can expect to find there.
There I talk about adventures and campaigns mostly. It's all of those, all the ideas that I have and have wanted to do for a long time. I start doing these projects and sometimes I finish them. Sometimes I get sidetracked on another one and I intend to go back and finish it after I've, you know, everything has an order. And so I have lots of projects on there and some of them are finished and some of them aren't, but they're all in my mind. They're all in progress. So if you have a favorite one, you just have to nudge me and I'll put that on my list. But it's, you know, adventures, campaigns. I love to make campaigns. So, you know, you get an idea for a campaign. There are so many ideas for campaigns. You can't possibly do them all. So I like to write them up and just at least they're there. And one day if I need something to run, then I can just do that. You know, it's ready.
41 years later, after your initial introduction to Dungeons and Dragons, do you get to play very often now?
Yes and no. There was a period where, I guess in the last 5 years, I was living in France for a while, and I played quite a lot during the the third edition era, and then into fourth edition. And then I started getting into old school. I'd sort of been following the old school renaissance since it started around 2000, in the 2000s somewhere. But third edition pretty much had me. I was very much into that. So I was looking at what was happening in old school. And then with fourth edition, I kind of got a little bit disillusioned. I said, you know what, I'm going to check out, you know, remember what was going on back then. And so I started getting more into original D&D and Basic and Expert from 1981 and Holmes and all those guys. And I wanted to understand Chainmail, and which was the war game that was before Dungeons and Dragons. And to understand Chainmail, Chainmail is like Indiana Jones might find a copy of Chainmail in the Ark and say, oh, what is this? And he would spend years deciphering what it means. In order to decipher Chainmail, you have to learn about war games. So I went back to Donald Featherstone and Tony Bath, who both were influences on Gygax and Arneson. And so once you understand the general idea of war games, then Chainmail starts to make some sense. There are still problems, but it starts to make some sense. So that took up a lot of time and gaming energy. And then the last, I've spent 4 years in Crete, and there's just nobody around there to play with. So I started doing some projects and started doing some solo gaming, some solo adventures. And that's a great way to do what you want. And, you know, all those little things that you always wanted to do, but nobody in their right mind is ever going to want to play OD&D, Original Dungeons and Dragons, using Chainmail as the combat system, which in the book it said use Chainmail for the combat system. Nobody's ever going to do that. So you can do that when you play by yourself, when you play solo. So I did a lot of that. So, and really for all of my life, whenever there wasn't players, whenever there weren't players around, I was still creating worlds and characters and monsters and reading the books, you know, the Dungeon Master's Guide. I probably read that thing 10 times over the years. There's always something to play. I feel like I play all the time.
That's fantastic. And, you know, the thing that I love most about our hobby is how many creative outlets it gives way to, whether it's cartography or art or writing, whether it's character backstories or full-fledged adventures, modules, and campaigns. And like you said, even if you don't have people to game with, you've got so many things that just keeps that creativity constantly being fed.
Exactly. And you know that there are so many different activities that I have this idea, this, I guess it's sort of a theory that it must exercise different parts of the brain depending on what sort of activity you're doing, whether you're making a map or you're trying to make a new rule, trying to fix an old rule, or role playing a character or designing a continent, or thinking about how the culture works, the socioeconomics and stuff like that. There's all kinds of different activities. And, you know, they say that the different sorts of things you do keeps your brain active. And so, like, you know, as we get older, we pick up the crossword puzzle and, you know, just to keep the brain active. And now it's Sudoku, I guess, or some other thing. But I think that's great. But I wonder if we don't need not just the crossword puzzle, but we need to have some other different activities to keep those all going. And the great thing about D&D is it has all of those. All you got to do is play D&D, and it, depending on what aspect you like, you can exercise different parts of the brain depending on what you like.
And you're absolutely right about that. The big thing is when you're gaming with younger people, it sparks that hunger to understand how things work. like you were talking about, you're designing kingdoms and continents and world building, and you want to understand how all these pieces work together. When you're 10, 11, 12, you don't have that knowledge, like how those things work, how those things worked in history. So that's where you go. You start reading books, you start searching the internet, and you start watching documentaries that you never would have watched. And you're doing it all from the standpoint of, I'm doing this so that my game will be more fun and interesting for my players, or sit down and play my character. I understand how a rogue in a medieval setting would have dressed and looked and acted. And with children, they are completely, and for those of us who grew up on it, like you and I did, we were completely tricked into falling in love with history, with science, with research, with books, because once you went down that rabbit hole of, oh, I've got an idea, but how do I make it work? How heavy is chainmail? How does a catapult actually work? You know, you start thinking those things, and then you have to start digging and researching and finding, and it just keeps going from there.
I spent a summer in the library learning about Egyptian mythology because I wanted to create a game setting in ancient Egypt with magic and monsters. And so I learned all about Osiris and all of that stuff. And I never played the game, but I still have all this knowledge about Egyptian mythology in my head. I thought it was so amazing and so cool. And recently, though, a couple of years ago, I started, I had this idea for a campaign going, and I was like, this is in a desert setting. This is going to be, I'm going to use Egyptian mythology as sort of my model to build this setting on. And it's beautiful. I was able to finally use, after 40 years, all of this stuff that I learned so long ago.
And you're right. I think all Dungeon Masters can agree that there are adventures that they never got to run, characters they never got to play, villains that the players never made it to that we'd love to have happen. So
exactly.
You're working on a new project, Fencer's Pandemonium Society House Rules. Tell us a little bit about this project. It is. tell us a little bit about this project and why it means so much to you, why you're so excited about it.
Well, in fact, it was the campaign that's set in ancient Egypt, or similar to that. It's the, Dyson Logos, who makes the maps.
Yes.
Right. Okay, everybody knows that guy. One of his maps is called the Deep Halls of Amon Gorloth, and it's a big map. You can print it out like 11 by 17, and it fits pretty well. It has seven different levels, and it's all convoluted. It kind of goes, you come in on like the second level, and you can go up to the first level, or down to the third level, or even down straight to the fifth level. And then you go back up. There's like, it's not, the levels aren't continuous or contiguous. You go from the second level down to the third, then back to the second level. It goes all over the place. He calls it twisted and nightmarish. Anyway, so I was stalking this dungeon. And what I was thinking when I first saw it, I said, I have to do that as a campaign. And it looks like Holmes Basic. I don't know why, it just did. When I look at it, I say, this is Holmes Basic. And so I started stalking it, and I was playing through it. I was running characters solo through it. This is during COVID, I think, even. So I was running characters through it and stalking it as I went, because you can do that too when you're playing solo. And I realized Holmes Basic, there are so many gaps in the rules, you really need to fix it a little bit. And so I had this idea to write house rules for Holmes Basic. And, you know, that has been done lots of times before. And not wanting to do anything simply, I had the idea to make house rules from the perspective, like you said, from a perspective of a group of 1980s pre-adolescent players. Just like, if I were back then, how would I have done it back then? And so I imagine these players doing that. And it kind of, I had this idea to write fictional newsletter kind of fanzine articles from that were published in a Wargamer newsletter at the time. You know, the big kids, they have their war games and they started playing D&D. And so now it's like war games and D&D. And so the kids publish articles in the big kids newsletter. And they also have their own newsletter that they saw what the big kids were doing. So they create their own thing, you know, and so they have their newsletter too. So the big kids newsletter is called L'Avant-Garde, which is, this is all fictional, of course. Mm-hmm. And so in my mind, in the fiction, the town that they're in, all of the war gamers, they had an association and they played mostly Napoleonic war games. So their newsletter, of course, is called L'Avant-Garde. And the kids who are playing, they created their own newsletter and they call it the Pandemonium Society. That's their group. Because when early on they were playing, there's like 20 kids over in this guy's kitchen and they're all sitting around the table, like two to a chair. They're sitting on the countertops and standing up and they're all laughing and screaming. And maybe there's a little swearing. And the mom walks in and she says, "What's all the pandemonium?" And so after that, they called their club, they call it the Pandemonium Society. They call it the whole name is the Pandemonium Society of Neighborhood Dungeons and Dragons Players. And so they have their newsletter called the Paradigm Lost. So they kind of get into who's the guy that wrote Paradise Lost? Milton, John Milton, kind of get into that theme with their adventures. You know, there's lots of demons and all that kind of stuff. And so this is all the fiction. And so I write these articles by Finster, one of the characters. He's like the guy who writes all the articles. And so he writes an article about what rules they use in their games, because they're trying to convince the big kids that the game they play, this basic, you know, they, when they first show the rule book to the big kids and say, do you want to come and play with us in our game? And he shows them the rule books and the guy says, basic is for kids, you know, and I had a guy tell me that too, when I was a kid. So this is from experience. It hurts, man. So they're essentially showing the big kids that the game they play it's worth playing. It's a big kid's game. It's sophisticated, right? So he writes these rules. He tells about the rules that they use or don't use from the book and shows them how it's different. And so and I try to write it like a kid would write it. And then I decipher it and try to write it like a more modern game designer would write it. Although I'm not much of a game designer myself, at best I'm an amateur game designer. So I write it with the words that a modern gamer would understand, and more concisely, you know. And just so I paraphrase the rules essentially to make sense.
And now, where can our listeners read your new project?
Dungeonlands.com. And then there's a category called Finster's Pandemonium Society House Rules.
What I liked about it, about how these early middle schoolers are trying to convince the big kids that this is a worthy endeavor, a great addition to their hobbies. It was very reminiscent for me, because I know that when folks who enjoy different aspects of gaming, whether it's card gamers and tabletop gamers, war gamers, when you mix all those folks into a small space together and they're competing for tables, it makes for some dynamic conversations.
Yeah, yeah, it's archetypal. There's, you know, no matter what edition or what, if some time separates different players, then there's always a Grognard. Yes. There's always one guy that says, the way you guys play those games today, it's just not right. You know, there's always somebody.
Stephen, what advice do you have for the folks listening at home to take that leap and jump into the old school renaissance and explore those early versions or these new games that are coming out, these new modules, these new adventures that take those simpler rules and it's a whole different style. It's a whole different style of gaming than what we're used to with these modern TTRPGs.
Yeah, it's you know, I've played every edition of Dungeons and Dragons, and I love them all for various, for each one for its own reason. Fifth edition, I probably, well, certainly have played the least of fifth edition, but I really love it because a lot of people have joined the game in fifth edition. So it's great. The older editions have their charm because they're mostly rules light. One of the things about the OSR, the old school Renaissance, is they stress rules light. Although back in the old school, we did have first edition Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, which was in no way rules light. It's tedious and complicated, and you just cannot play that game using all the rules as they're written. It's just not possible. Aside from that, though, it is easier to play some of those games because they are simpler. There's less text to read. There's less to know about when you start. In particular, my favorite edition, I guess my favorite edition is the Basic and Expert set from 1981, edited by Tom Moldvay and David Cook and Steve Marsh. That set since Basic is for kids, but since the 2000s when the OSR got launched, I was validated when I started reading in bulletin boards about people talking about, we used to say BX Basic is for kids and all that stuff, but looking at the rules now, they're really a well-written set of rules, kind of coherent. It makes a lot of sense. It's really nice. And so I was like, okay, finally people are catching on. Because that was the second set. That was the first set that I really read and understood everything in it after I learned from Holmes. It's all the rules in two 64-page rule books. The Dungeon Master has to read the first 64-page rule book in order to run a game during the first three levels. But it's pretty easy to pick up. The players don't really have to know anything at all to start. You just have to give them a few pointers. You know, there are seven different classes to choose from, and that's it. You don't have to get into, you know, different species and races and all that stuff. And it's the rules are easy to get into. There's not so much skill checks, so it's easier to. It's more about the player skill than about the character skill. So your character has arcane knowledge and all that because he's a magic user, but you still have to solve this puzzle by yourself. You know, you have to work with your teammates, and you know, that's what the game is all about anyway. You don't get away with it just by rolling less than your or higher than some score, you know, to solve the puzzle. You have to work with the players around the table and figure it out. So in fact, I had this idea lately when I talk with a lot of people who are into applied role-playing games for, you know, there's kind of like you are in with education and parents and children and teaching that. There's a couple of other axes. I think of them as different axes. There's therapy. There's like therapy for autistic children and autistic adults. therapy for all sorts of things. I'm involved with Game Therapy UK, that they do gaming for various groups, including military veterans. I'm a military veteran, so I'm involved in that group. So one of
thank
the
you for your
big
service.
Things they you're welcome. It's one of the big things that they have games for is just purely socialization, because a veteran who maybe with PTSD or some other problem and stuff, that you tend to, with those sorts of problems, you tend to not talk about them. And that's what you think about. So you don't talk to anybody. And so you get isolated. So just playing the game with a few other people, whether it's around a table or online, gets you out of your shell a little bit. But lots of people say, when I talk to them, they say, yeah, fifth edition is cool, but it's, you know, there's a lot of rules to read and to know about. And you feel like if you don't read all of the three big, those giant books, the books, man, are so dense. They're so heavy. So I'm like, you know, BX is only, you know, 64 times two pages, and it's pretty easy to get into. You know, character generation takes minutes. Leveling up takes practically seconds. It doesn't have the skill checks that sometimes can shortcut your problem, your obstacle a little bit. And it's got all the role playing in there. It's called Dungeons and Dragons. It's got that cachet. In fact, it's probably, if we look at the original Dungeons and Dragons, compare it to BX, Basic and Expert from 1981, BX is really a well-edited rendition of the original Dungeons and Dragons. It's kind of like we imagine Gygax's marching orders to Tom Moldvay was, take OD&D and make it, you know, a coherent game, and then we'll do the expert set and have it for all the levels, and, you know, make this a good, a coherent game, something for role players. Now that role players exist, let's write a game for them. And don't put any of that stuff from AD&D, because that's my AD&D stuff, because of the whole schism between Arneson and Gygax at the time. So it really is a really good rendition of original D&D. I love BX. And
one of my favorite modules from the BX era is Keep on the Borderlands. And I have run Keep on the Borderlands many, many times for different tables of players. And I've actually ran it in several different rule sets. I've ran it with third edition. I've ran it with fifth edition. I have always enjoyed how the players react to that sandbox and the decisions they make and where they end up. So it's near and dear to my heart, Keep on the Borderlands. And that comes right from that original BX time period. Stephen, thank you again for being on the show. Thank you for all that you're doing for the gaming community. All of the projects that you have, the books, the book series, the blogs, they are bringing folks back to not just the joy of gaming, but all of those creative outlets that gaming brings. I love everything that you're doing on dungeonlands.com to keep up with the blog and see what's coming out next.
It was my pleasure, Nick. It was great fun.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Raised on D&D Podcast. Be sure to subscribe and follow on all your favorite apps and social media.